Welcome to Project Chatter, the podcast where PPM experts from various sectors talk about the latest trends. Listen to Val and Dale as they talk about tried and tested best practices and share their unfiltered thoughts about the industry. Whether you're here to learn how to progress your career, improve your project control skills, or just want to hear an Aussie and South African rant about projects, then you've come to the right place. Welcome to the Project Chatter podcast with your hosts, Dale Fung and Val Matthews.
In today's economic climate, construction cost and schedule overruns can be disastrous.
Innate construction software helps you spot risks before they happen.
Their cloud-based solutions give you the real-time insights you need to minimize risk and improve operational efficiency.
With Innate, you keep projects on schedule and under budget. Get started today at innate.com. That's INEIGHT.com. In this week's pod, we were joined by Joe Little to discuss the challenges of project managing communications-based train control, also known as CBTC, technology on brownfield railways. Joe is an experienced and accomplished director with extensive rail project management capability gained in a highly regulated industry. He's a project management professional from the chartered body APM.
Joe has been instrumental in developing a range of diagnostic and modelling tools capable of being tailored to specific railway networks. This has included the introduction of condition-based maintenance for multiple mass transit CBTC railways in North America, Asia, and the Middle East. Well, Dale, that was an interesting podcast. Learned some things about Joe that we didn't know before. Having worked with him before, I had no idea he was a football coach at Millwall. That was amazing. But yeah, we discussed some quite interesting things, some of the parallels between sports and rail projects, a bit more closer than I thought originally. I quite liked his analogy about building the factory. I won't spoil it, but really, really enjoyed that one. How about you? What were your main takeaways?
Yeah, you know, I think Joe really brings the emphasis on, you know, experience and getting to site and getting perspective on the projects you're working on delivering, not just sitting behind a desk or computer and actually getting, you know, to site. And I really like that, you know, it's a key emphasis of building that perspective and that experience. But the other thing that we spoke a lot around is, you know, projects don't actually plan to continuously train, learn lessons, time for mentoring, time for learning curves. And so that's interesting as well. So hopefully the listeners can gain something out of that. But as you say, Martin, we don't want to spoil it all. We'll let the listeners make up their minds. So we'll leave it there. And as we keep saying, keep listening, keep liking, and keep paying it forward. Hello, project people, and welcome back to a brand new episode of the Project Chatter podcast. As you've probably guessed, no Val Matthews on this episode, but we do have Mr. Martin Carriston back in the saddle. Martin, how are you doing?
Yep, good, thanks. Yeah, and yourself?
Yeah, not too bad, not too bad. Do you know where Val is?
No, no idea. He's missing in action again.
Missing in action again. Someone who knows about missing in action probably is Joe Little, because he is our guest today. How are you, sir?
Yeah, really royal gentleman. Good to be here today.
Yeah, no, it's our pleasure to have you. And I'm sure some of you'll touch on your coaching, your soccer, as the non-English call it, or the Americans call it, but football this side of the pond. Your football coaching days as well, where perhaps some players went missing in action. But before we get to that, we haven't actually settled on a topic, so to speak, but we know you, we know your background, but the listeners might not know who you are and what you do. Do you mind sort of giving us your origin story, sort of where you are today, maybe start there, and how you got to where you are today?
Yeah, it would be a pleasure. It's not the most conventional of routes. I'll start where I am today. So I'm currently director of a company called CPC Systems, which is part of a bigger consultancy called CPC LLP. So we've been delivering railway projects in CPC for 35 years, and the CPC Systems division was formed 8 years ago. And I'll talk you through how I got there. So I found myself working on the Jubilee and Northern Line upgrade almost 15 years ago. Fell out of football. I made my way into a railway, which is not the most conventional route for probably most of the listeners. Although when I meet a lot of railway people, not everyone planned on landing on the railway and staying, but most of us who land there tend to. So, I've been at CPC the last 8 years, growing our systems division. And it's all about focusing on delivering railway control systems into the railway environment. And that's been going really well. Prior to that, I worked at Thales, and that's where the Jubilee Northern Line experience was gained. So met some really good people. And I landed in via one of my football connections, actually. So, not the most conventional routes. So my coaching capability gave me the opportunity to go and work on the railway environment. So that's quite an interesting lead in, isn't it? So, yeah, long story short, an opportunity came up to be an assistant project manager. I had some good management skills from my football coaching career, and that's how I entered onto the railway. And I found myself delivering signalling equipment room desks and chairs, which I thought was going to be an easy entry into the railway. But I quickly learned that even the procurement of desks and chairs for a room wasn't that easy. that was certainly a welcome to the railway as a first gig. So, yeah, spent 5 good years at Thales, met some amazing people, delivered some amazing project outcomes for London Underground and TfL, and then decided to kind of replicate what I did within Thales and bring some value to the delivery of complex systems into railway environments. So, prior to landing in Thales, I touched on the coaching, kind of work back to the origin story. So I was a coach at a well-known football club called Millwall, which is a club in southeast London, really close to my heart. I grew up 5 minutes from the ground as a youngster, and I was fortunate enough there to be their academy manager. So for those of you who are not familiar with football, I looked after their whole youth system, everything from under 18s down to under 7s, I think it was, we had back then. So the whole youth program, so that looks involved looking after the players, the coaching, and the ethos of how we brought young players into the first team environment. I was very young. I was 24 when I got that job, which is pretty unheard of in the football world to hold a job of that level of responsibility. The club took a huge leap of faith, giving me that role. I'm forever grateful to them for that. Millwall sometimes gets a lot of bad press for its fans and such like, but I've only ever got good things to say. It's my club. I've supported them from a young lad and continue to do so today. Story goes back from there, though. So landed that job at 24. I joined the club as a 12-year-old. So I joined their academy. Well, back then it was called a Centre of Excellence. So I made my way through the youth systems, and I made my way into the under-18s, which was the youth team, as it's known, and also played in the reserve team quite a bit. And I was really fortunate to play with some fantastic players, learn a lot about life, developing through that football pathway, and actually got to play with some great players. So in my youth team, probably the players who went on to do some amazing things were Tim Cahill, who know that about. Oh, wow. So we're associated with from his Australian roots. And another top player was Stephen Reid. But many of the others went on to have good careers as well. So I was kind of steeped in that football history from a young age. Built some really good friendships. Some of those are long-lasting. But obviously did develop some, I suppose, leadership capabilities in that as well, right? It's a tough environment from being a young footballer in an elite environment like that. You have to have high standards. You have to know how to work with people in that team environment. You know, and it kind of grew from there. I was unfortunate I got injured at 18 and I had to retire. Completely finished playing football at 18. And this is where, again, I go back to Millwall as a football club. I was never really had a plan other than football. The club gave me a job in the academy, which allowed me to get huge amounts of hours of coaching experience. They supported me through university. I went and done my sports science degree. And then I went into some teaching as well. So I got some classroom experience. I did a postgraduate certificate of education, which again was phenomenal experience for understanding people. And that's a huge bit of, if I look at my style in everyday life, it's about understanding people. If you understand the people and how to get the best out of them, you can generally do great things. And yeah, I managed to grow through that coaching pathway. I was pretty young. I was one of the youngest in Europe to get the UEFA license. So I was 24 when I got that. And yeah, people like, I did my A license with Dean Smith, who was the, I lose track of where he's been now. I think he was formerly at Leicester, wasn't he? Trying to keep them in the Premier League. Yeah, and a couple of other good names who have gone on to do some good things in the coaching space. But yeah, so it was a journey into there. Spent 2 or 3 years in that senior role at Millwall. And then the opportunity came up to do something completely different. And it wasn't directly into RAO, actually. There was another step along the journey. So I decided to go and trade oil futures in the city for a year. Always had a bit of an aspiration to do that. So tried that for a year. I wasn't very successful. Hence how I landed in the railway. it's been a phenomenal journey. And pleased to say, yeah, I wasn't sure at first when I landed in the railway industry whether it was going to be for me. But the amount of learning that I've managed to undertake since joining the rail industry, the support I've had from phenomenal people, and I'll kind of give a big shout out to a lot of people on it, really. So when I landed, I had no experience of railways. And I think the railway industry, one thing it has got, it's got some phenomenal mentors who give back more than other industries I've been involved in, actually.
Looking at the huge challenges you face when delivering an operational upgrade to a live railway, if I compare it to my football experience, all I had to do in football was focus on those 3 points. Yeah, I never had that outside factor to consider. I never had to think about anything other than just focusing on my 3 points. With these upgrades, when you're going into that operational live environment, there's always third-party stakeholders to deal with, whether that's people who are granting you the access, whether that's the passengers who you want to find to make sure you cause minimal disruption, to the subcontractors who are working for you with the amount of time you're giving them. So the constant challenges we have is our subcontractors, if they're lucky, get 4 hours. God forbid if someone else tries to work in the same area because you haven't booked exclusive access and your productivity goes down. It's a nightly battle to make sure that your contractor can go out there and deliver the value that they want to deliver. I'm convinced no one in the railway doesn't want to deliver maximum value, because you're always dealing with these third parties who are protecting the railway, right? It can be frustrating, but you need to be able to understand the other side of the fence where different stakeholders need access. It might be safety critical maintenance that needs to be undertaken. It might be other upgrades that are needed to enhance the railway operation. So you're constantly in this position where you're having to think about others. And despite those others being in the mix, still finding your way of delivering the value that you need to. So yeah, completely different to the football world. A lot more to think about. And it's, for me, in railways, it's used a lot, integration, but it's just interfaces. If you don't understand how you're going to operate with that interface so you can work together to deliver value, then you will struggle. You have to be really good at that people element to find ways through. And you look at it, I look at it as less competitive. I've worked on the contractor side and the client side. You need to find the win-wins there. If the client doesn't get what they need at the end, then the upgrade's been for nothing. And unfortunately, in our industry, we've seen that a few times. And I think those ones that have failed, it comes down to the people being able to work together and find their way through some of the challenges that we've just described. So hugely important on any railway upgrade.
Yeah, I'm with you there. And can you give, I guess, a bit of insight as to any tips and tricks and how you manage those interfaces, how you manage those relationships with those competing, I guess, priorities?
So I've been really fortunate in my career on the big upgrades I've worked on. And I think this is overlooked. So we've been really fortunate. We've co-located with the client and the supplier. And I've been involved when that hasn't been the case. And I think when you, it's used a lot, and sometimes it can come across a bit cheesy, this one team. It's hard to be one team when things get commercially difficult, as we all know on this call. We've been on the opposite side of the fences when there's been challenges. But if you're able to truly collaborate, work within the parameters of your contract, you always got to respect that, but find ways of making each other successful. That's what I feel. Again, I've been brought up some really good mentors on the supplier and the client side. And those mentors have always told me, you've got to look beyond just the contract. You've got to respect the contract and make sure you administer it. But the job won't be delivered just solely on how you administer that contract. You have to find solutions and win-wins that can help everyone be successful. And I think those skills and developing the relationships are huge for me. I would say I spend a large part of my day making sure the relationships are intact so that we can deliver. I'm not an email warrior. So a lot of the people who work with me will know I don't send huge amounts of emails. Most of my work is done in face-to-face meetings with people where possible, or I prefer those one-to-one engagements, whether it's on a Teams call, whether it's on the phone. I think because if you've got the amount of interfaces we have to deal with, having those relationships on hand where you can go and actually work your way through an issue rather than with 10 people in the room where you never really resolve anything, one-to-one relationships with the empowered people are key. And that's probably one of the criticisms I've got in RAL. I do note this, and I find it hugely frustrating in my day-to-day delivery. Sometimes I have to go through 3 or 4 people to get to the actual person who has to deliver, who's empowered to deliver. So one of the big things for me and RAL, if we improve things, it's about getting the accountable people together in a room to find solutions. That's really, really important, because when you get to the cold face with the right people, there's not many things you can't work through in the railway environment. I believe there's always solutions to be found. So it's really important you get the right people together. And less meetings with some of the meetings we was in previously with 20 people around the table don't always deliver you the value that people anticipate they will. So close working relationships and the spirit to develop the right solutions is key.
So in your role, you've had to try and build and lead high-performing teams, ultimately to get the job done, to time, cost, quality, and whilst maintaining those relationships. Obviously, you know, when you're working on projects, you have to make do with what you've got. You don't have the finances of a Pep Guardiola. You can't just pick and choose who you want. So what are the things that you look for when you come into a project and you're trying to develop some of these high-performing teams, or what do you look for when you're trying to recruit into your team?
It's a really good question. I think like any good football manager, before you go and recruit externally, you often find the majority of the right people are on your job already, but maybe they've been put into the wrong position. So I'm really big on finding those people who really understand the product. So in my world, the CBTC product's key. That's a bit of a challenge for us because the product experts are actually based in Canada. So that's where the design authority sits. But we've got some phenomenal people in the UK who understand the product. So being able to find those people and put them in a position where they can truly influence the outcomes is key. And then partnering those experts up with people who understand the other side of it, which are, as you mentioned, the time, cost and quality elements. If you can build those relationships between the PMs and the technical authorities to come up with the right delivery strategies, that's where, for me, the magic happens. And it's hugely important those relationships are developed. So kind of final bit in answer to your question. Find the right people internally first. Make sure if they're there, use them and put them in the right position where they can influence. And then, for me, it's if you're going to bring in external people, making sure they've got the right competencies. And then the last bit of the answer I would say is go back to my experience. I'm only on this call with you today because there was a strong, and it wasn't a formal mentorship program. Yeah, it was informal. There was people who were giving back. So making sure you've got that right blend of experience and experienced people who are willing to give. Because those experienced people then, it propagates through the team. And if they mentor, and the best ones I've known have said they want to design themselves out of the process. So they keep loading up the team underneath them to give them the experiences to then replace them. I think we need more of that in the railway industry. I think most of the jobs I've been on, and I'm kind of one of the things I am probably most proud of, whoever I've worked with, I've always tried to make them better. I've made myself better in the process because that learning and mentorship cycle, it works for everyone. So whether you're the mentor giving or the person who's receiving the mentorship, both of you benefit by that experience. And I think we need more and more of that. And I'm noticing in probably a bit controversial. So listen, I'll sit here as a consultant. And we have a lot of contract staff in the industry. And some phenomenally competent people. But I think there's a responsibility to give back regardless of your contractual terms, let's call it. You should always be looking to whatever organisation you're working for. You should be able to walk out and go, actually, do you know what? I've improved their people. So, yeah, I'm quite passionate about that. And I think
something that companies can almost write into contracts, almost having when they are taking on consultants, you know, you're paying a premium for that experience. Do you think they should be doing things like knowledge transfer? Is that
it's really
to incentivize it? Or?
It's really popular now. So any bid you go for these days, there is definitely criteria around that. And I think, it's becoming more mainstream. And I think it's fine just from the consultant perspective, but I think everyone on the project needs to be. I think anyone working on that project, there should be something written in which says, what are you doing to enhance the abilities of those around you? And I think, as I say, education's key on projects, certainly with the complex systems we deliver. And this is, if I walk into the office tomorrow, there's someone sitting in that office who was exactly like I was when I joined the industry. They probably don't know the product. They don't know the constraints that they're going to be placed under, and they're thrown into the lines then to say, right, you need to deliver this in the next week. And that's what's key. So for me, if you've got a constant learning environment on your project, as the project evolves, people evolve. And for me, then that's the way you produce the future leaders. And I've been lucky enough that a lot of people I've worked on have gone on to do some great things. So I think that's really, really important.
Yeah, it's an interesting one as well, Joe. I'm almost the other way, where I challenge clients to say, if you have to write in to a contract that the consultant has to transfer knowledge as part of what they do, then you're using the wrong consultancy.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Because a consultant should be doing that. They should, by their very nature, be going in and leaving and imparting knowledge and leaving whichever organization they're dealing with in a better state than which they found it, regardless of the type of engagement. So that's my challenge to clients, because often they don't ask for the right things from consultancies, in my view. But let's not go down that rabbit hole, I think. The one I do want to go down is the whole mentorship, and I guess also the future leaders that you brought up, because I think it's quite important, specifically in the current climate we're finding ourselves, where we talk a lot about AI and machine learning and all these, technology solutions out there today. But I think we're losing track of people in the mix. And, if you look particularly in the past few years, those that have entered the industry, and we've said this, a few pods, they lack the ability, I think, to socially interact at work, because they've sort of joined work post-pandemic. They don't fully appreciate, understand, what it's like to be, on-site, in the office, having those challenging conversations, and it's okay. They've got the ability to hide behind the camera or turn it off. And so how do we build leaders for the future? And also, how do we make mentors available? Because it was easier when people were together, I think. to go, hey, look, you know, this is the direction you want to head in. There's that person over there. You know, you can grab 5 minutes with them once a day, a week, and it's no bother. Now it's sort of trying to set time aside. It's a bit more structured. I don't know. What are your thoughts around that? Because we want to encourage people to come into the industry. We definitely need more leaders, giving people more experience faster. Do you have any thoughts around that? And I particularly think back to when you're describing your route in football. And it certainly sounds like you were given the right opportunities at a very young age. And so how do we pay that forward?
So the best example I can give. So let's touch on the technology for a second because it's relevant. So the development of the Teams app transformed our ability to work remotely. And I think it's been a huge positive change, which has enabled people to work more efficiently. So I'm a massive supporter of Teams and kind of just the whole video conferencing capability. But you're absolutely right. For new people coming in industry, I'm passionate about how they develop the kind of, as you say, those personal skills and the site-based skills. You only learn by doing. So Good Friday, over the Easter holiday, I was on site with a couple of my staff. We had a big job. It was like 1:30 in the morning. We're at the famous Neasden Depot. And on a Good Friday, do I want to be in Neasden Depot? Definitely not. I've got 5 kids at home who are looking forward to the Easter holidays. And so I'm on site. Did I absolutely need to be on site? Probably not. But from a mentoring perspective and a leadership perspective, it was vital that I was there. And by taking people along with me, they get to see the work that we talk about every day in the office. They get to be amongst what I call the real delivery people, the people who are out and say implementing all of this was a test and commissioning shift, you know, the test and commissioning of the system we've spent probably the last 3 years putting in the ground. So understanding the challenges those testers face, the time constraints, the pressures, the interface with a maintenance organization, are you going to get it back in time and all that good stuff? You don't get that from being on a screen. So the mentoring for me is about, if you're a leader and you think it's only going to be done via on screen, I think that's going to be really hard in our industry. Might be different in others, I don't know. But certainly football, you're never going to be able to do that. But face-to-face time, on-site, watching the work is vital because that's when you get your real learning. So yeah, I think that's really important. And I think the more you get leaders doing that, being on-site with their teams, the more you're going to see the future leaders come through the system.
So we had a guest on the other week, and he was talking about he's almost trying to create a project controls degree. He's almost saying that there is a lack of specific degree programs. And I know there are project management degree programs out there, but if you were designing a program, you know, apprenticeship, a degree program for aspiring project managers, what would be your kind of curriculum? What would be your year one? Is it get them out on site? Is it learn the technical side of the job that you're going to do? Is it learn the specifics of project management? Like, what do you learn planning, how to do cost, all that kind of stuff? Like, where would you focus your attention first to get the most benefit if you were designing something like that?
I think it's very specific to the industry. So the project management profession can be generic.
Yeah.
There's a lot of generic skills, and you can train in the generic application of project management. Yeah. And I think there's some phenomenal courses, whether they're degrees, whether they're going for your charter ship via the APM and going through that route. There's multiple routes to be able to develop your technical competency in project management. It's something I'm really passionate about, actually. So I've managed to do that theory, and it gave me a fantastic grounding. But the application of that theory into your environment is key. So if you transfer from, call it aviation, into rail as a project manager, I'm having some conversations with that at the moment, and vice versa, I think there's got to be a level of respect for the domain knowledge that you need to go and do the hard yards with. So there will definitely be some cross-pollination between the different industries, but that domain knowledge is key. So go back to my point about being at Knees End Depot at 1 o'clock on a good Friday morning. Yeah, I'm building that domain expertise. I'm meeting the stakeholders. I'm understanding the constraints of my environment. And we kicked this off with the constraints of rail. Yeah. Again, you can't learn that by reading the document. You can stand in as many seminars as you want and listen. Until you see that for yourself, you're never truly going to be able to create a program that's realistic. So for me, that's really, really important. And it's something I've been talking to. So the Institute of Railway Signalling Engineers. So I'm a project manager who works within signalling. So I'm working my way through the RSE exams. I'm getting a lot of questions back from people. Why would you be studying that? You don't want to be a signalling engineer. And I'm like, that knowledge allows me to deliver my projects better. So I'm getting an insight into the signalling engineer now, who's telling me how long they need for design and what their constraints are. So I've now got more of an appreciation of the true domain area I'm working in. And it's vitally important. I think if you're going to be, as I say, this is kind of for me now. I've kind of always had aspirations of doing different things, but I've locked in now on the signalling element of it. The industry for me it achieves phenomenal things. Despite the bad press it gets, it achieves phenomenal things. Like, I'll get on the Jubilee Northern Line, I'll get on the DLR, look at the four lines that we're upgrading currently. You get on there, the performance is amazing. Gets you where you need to get to much faster than the legacy systems ever could. So the products are amazing. This is just Metro. As you look at the main line and what's coming there is really exciting also. But I think it needs more, certainly from a project management perspective, I think an alignment between the Association of Project Management and the IRSE could transform the industry. Because the more you get the project managers understanding the domain knowledge and how the people who work in the industry have to operate, it's like your testing commissioning. Prime example, you ever work with a tester? I remember it was one of the most difficult conversations I've ever had, asking the tester, why do you need that amount of time on that shift? And the look I got across the table, it was uncomfortable for me, right? But so the way I earned the respect from that tester was I went out on the shift with him and understand the constraints they're under. And if they don't put things back after their test, what that means the next morning when they're watching those first trains go through and the passengers are on them. So then I start to understand the key things that are driving my schedule. So can I get them a closure where they can achieve maybe 10-15 hour shifts within one weekend closure, and then trying to make a business case for that against stopping people traveling around London? All of those things, like, you start to get a greater appreciation of the true cost of delivering a railway upgrade. And the fact that tester's got a license, yeah, and he's been entrusted by that Institute of Railway Signalling to make sure he does things in the correct way so that passengers get there safely and he doesn't create disruption on the railway the next morning. So he protects that license because that's his livelihood. And you need to understand that. Going away in a room and going to a tester, there's your schedule, definitely doesn't work. You have to work it from the bottom up. And that's the key. The more you can understand from the ground how to build, the better. And that's why I think, go back to your question, apprenticeships, massive support with those. My nephew is doing an apprenticeship in quantity surveying, and he's been working on jobs since day one. He's got a huge edge over the ones that have come out of university and have never been on a job. He's learned from bottom up. And I think if we can get more of that in the industry, I think it will make the industry better.
Yeah, I agree with that. And it's interesting listening to you there, because you place a huge emphasis on experience. And I agree with that. You know, it's that application of what you've learned, the theory which you've picked up in the classroom, and how you actually apply that. Because if you think about it, it's vanilla theory across the piece, but then every project has their little, you know, their little quirks that you've got to account for. And so it's quite interesting. But one of the things that I've been trying to formulate in my head, Joe, because I like to compare sports as well with projects and what can we borrow from them, is, well, there's one thing that you mentioned there, you know, sort of the way to get, there's an acknowledgement, right, that to get match fit, you play matches, right? You can't train and get match fit. You have to play matches. So that's great, because you're going to site, and I guess that's my equivalent of getting match fit, is you're actually experiencing what's going on. So you're gaining that experience. But the week of training before a match, getting ready to face a certain opposition or, you know, play in a certain way with certain tactics, is there an equivalent training pitch that we could sort of have when we're delivering projects? Because I struggle with that piece, because if you look, and my borrowing's from rugby, naturally, being South African, you know, if you're playing the All Blacks versus playing England versus playing anyone, you're going to have a different tactic when you go out. So you're going to train differently during that week. Is there an equivalent in projects?
So the thing about projects, the training is, it's an interesting concept. So I liken if I look at the rail industry, a football team's similar. It's a bit of a factory, isn't it? Yeah. So, and you're starting a factory with a project, right? It's not a BAU. Yeah. So when you go into a football club, rugby club, same principle, you want to implement your vision. Yeah. And I think you've got to start with the vision. How is it you want to play? So what are your strategies and your tactics? And how are you going to produce that output? So we've already spoke about recruitment, the right people, which is huge. But then I think you get into the processes. And I did a LinkedIn article on this actually a couple of years ago. So for me, you've got to build the factory first. So you listen, we've all worked in projects. From day one, you've got to have that schedule that you've signed up to and what your working assumptions are. But for me, the first, depending on what the scale of the project is, but validating those assumptions in the field are key. Yeah. So the training ground for me in the early days of a project is, if I said I'm going to design 30 assets a week, yeah, can I just do one a week that gets through the sausage machine in the right way? Once I've done one, let's learn from that one and then scale to 30. What I find in my experience of these big projects is we run at 30 and make loads of mistakes, and we've got to go and repair 30. So again, going back to one of my first experiences on a railway was the first article inspection of a new product. Yeah, because if I put my project controls out on here for a second and with a schedule focus, validating the assumptions that schedule are built on a key. So is your factory set up to be able to produce the outputs you need? Do you understand all the bear traps along the way on that process where you're going to get caught, where you're going to get a 10-day wait for someone to sign off a document which can take an hour because the contract says it takes 10 days? Understanding all those intricacies are key. So for me, the training ground, probably not the best analogy, but refining your skills, which is what you do in training, in our world is about understanding your factory and how you get, whether it's a design, whether it's a piece of kit you need to install, whether it's the test and commission element of it, are you truly understanding that process flow and all the bits, all the places where that process can get halted? Like we've been there, where you go through a lengthy process to agree a design with a maintainer, and you get to the point it gets in the ground, and then all of a sudden we don't like it and we change. So understanding those risks, mitigating those risks, and having the strategies and tactics in place to deal with those are really important. But for me, if you build the factory and you're really hot on refining how that factory operates, so you get a constant production line that's going to deliver you the output, that's where, for me, hopefully I've explained it, where the the training ground similarities are. And then for me, I'll give you an example from my career. I got dropped in to manage a design team. It was a civil and mechanical design team, part of the signalling upgrade. And we needed to get a phenomenal amount of assets out per week as a design output to feed an installation contractor that we'd subcontracted to. Most of the people who work with me are laughing when I say this, but for me, it's all about requirements. We had new subsystems. We didn't understand the subsystem. We didn't understand the requirements of how to place that asset in the environment and how to consider the brownfield environment we was going into. So we're having to hang antennas on tunnel crowns, which is a no-no with the asset engineers, the civil people. We had to go through all that approval process. So I've got a factory that says I'm going to produce 50 a week. I haven't even got it signed off to do one at the moment. So from day one, I'm losing. So how do I get the factory set up quickly to then catch up? So all those challenges. So you train on the job is what you have to do. But you have to have the end goal in mind of how it is, go back to football, you want to play and the steps you've got to go through to build that competency within the team to be able to implement your vision. And those skills, again, they're not in a manual. So if you're the project manager responsible for those outputs, you've got to understand the civil asset engineer's requirements for whether he's going to allow you to put something in his 150-year-old tunnel. Yeah, how do you agree that? So he's going to want to see a risk assessment. He's going to want to know that competent people have been and assessed the asset to make sure it's in good condition. You've got to look at the inspection records on that. You started on all those bits together. That's just to get one asset in. I had 300 of them. And that's my point about learn to do one and then scale. And that's how your people train and they develop those skills. I think the tragedy with RAL, which is, so my family run a mechanical and electrical contracting business. And it's not entirely, but there's a lot of click repeat. Similar environments, it's a commercial, mechanical, electrical builds. And they learn lessons in this lot of repetitive business and they work through and they get. We back on? So we hone those skills in RAL. And where's the next job? I think you get these big, huge, major projects. The job finishes and then all the skill sets are lost. And then you might get lucky and find another job similar if there's the funding environment available in the country you're in for that. So the big project we're on at the moment, you've got a huge volume of resources to develop some really unique skills. Is there going to be work for the contractor post that? So truly the lessons can be learned and we can build better in the future. I think in RAL it's boom and bust, just the nature of the environment. So yeah, where other industries, I think, benefit from the continuous lessons learned and the progress, I think we take huge strides forward and then we fall off the edge of a cliff and have to start again. And I don't think that can be underestimated. It's a huge challenge.
How would you, in an ideal world, how would you try and get around that? You know, the lessons learned is one of the buzzwords on projects, but my experience, I've never really seen it done well. And, you know, they may be in a Excel spreadsheet somewhere, but how can we really learn those lessons? Because projects are still overspending, they're still behind schedule. You know, you look at the data from all the major infrastructure projects, we don't seem to be learning. There might be some, you know, optimism biases in there, but in an ideal world, how would you try and learn those lessons on, let's say, signaling projects?
I think the recruitment's huge, people. Listen, you can do as many lessons learned workshops as you want and put stuff in spreadsheets and for people to read through. I think you need to be targeting the people who have done previously what you have, what you're intending to undertake. You would in any other industry. You'd go and get the subject matter experts and make sure they're working on your job. And then what you would do, you'd have them in your senior positions and part of those top people coming in, you'd use them to grow your future leaders from within. goes back to the point at the start. I don't think you can manufacture lessons learned. You need to get the people in who have got the experience, proven experience as well. And listen, no doubt we've worked with people who say they've been on the jobs. But I think when you're bringing someone in, the specifics of the job, you have to test that. Where are you going to add value? And making sure that they can come in and bring that value to your project. I think that's really, really important if you really want to develop lessons learned.
But the challenge with that might be a hard sell to some management people. You know, those people come with a premium. Ultimately, it's worth it. You must have fought some battles over the year trying to justify some of those costs over a longer term, you know, paying the premium for that experience. There's probably a challenge in there somewhere, I imagine.
There is, but you're not talking big volumes here. I think sometimes it's where we get it wrong. Go back to my point. If I land on a job, I can guarantee you there's some pretty good experts on that job already. They might just be in the wrong position. If I look at some of the clients I work with, they could go anywhere in the world and deliver value. Their knowledge is phenomenal. So I would say, yeah, you haven't got to go and if you bring the right people in with the right motivations, I think it pays for itself tenfold because they're going to develop your people. And if you're an organization who's trying to create a legacy, then that's going to bear fruit in the future as well, isn't it? So I think be very targeted with who you want. And then listen, if it's a true project environment and there is an internal capability, that's a different story. But I think it's definitely horses for courses. Depends on your individual project, what your aspirations are as an organization. Are you intent on building your own? If you are, you got to make sure those mentors are there. Now, whether they're internal or external people, I'd be agnostic on that. I just want my people working with the best so I can grow that next generation. And again, I was really fortunate. Make no bones about it. I would not be sitting here today having the experience I've got if I didn't land in an environment which kind of had those top people who were mentoring freely, right? Not instructed to, freely given away. And I think kind of look, if I look at the best people, they do that as a matter of course, right? So yeah, that's how I would probably answer that question.
It's a fair way to answer it because, I mean, the key driver to why Val and I started this podcast is we felt we were very fortunate with our mentors around us that, you know, freely gave to us. And so this is our way to pay it forward to everyone that wants to listen. So it does really resonate with us. And it's interesting listening to you talk about training, talking about mentorship, talking about lessons learned. And I think one of the major failings we have across all projects is we don't actually plan to make space for learning. As you say, you know, you start off with one and you want to scale up and then you get the economies of scale because you get the efficiencies. But that's not how we plan to deliver projects, right? And so inevitably what happens is you learn all of your lessons at the end when all the risks happen because you just kick the can down the road.
Yep.
Where if you actually learned those up front, your economies of scale means that actually you should then learn faster, sooner, quicker, make less mistakes near the end. And then, you know, let's test the hypothesis. I don't know which project out there, mega project, is happy to test the hypothesis of making all the mistakes in the beginning and then having smooth sailing for the remainder, however long that tail might be. But I wonder, do you have a viewpoint on how we potentially start projects better, particularly complex projects? Because the few that you've worked on, and I say few, but they've been over many years and they're very complex, right? Large mega projects. They're not just complex from a aspect of they're live and operational. You're dealing with different teams in different countries, different cultures, different time zones, trying to coordinate this all, multiple layers of supply chain. How do we make the time and space for us to learn upfront on projects and plan better to have that space for the mentoring, the coaching, the lessons learned, the training, etc.? Because often if you did that, I think people wouldn't sign off a project.
Yeah, if you're the sponsor and you're getting people to buy into you're going to make mistakes at the start, it's a hard, hard thing to do, isn't it? People have bought a shiny new toy and they're trusting their contractor to get it in exactly as they said they would. Most of the time, underestimating the help the contractor needs. Yeah. Understand that you're part of it because it's an operational environment and all that good stuff. I'm just obsessed in this factory analogy. Yeah. For me, one of my big focuses I would be looking at is I would be, if I put my client hat on for a second, like kind of the role I'm doing at the moment, I want to work with that supplier and I want the transparency and the openness for them to fail and be confident failing at the start so we can help get that factory working at the rate we need to. So I would, having a huge emphasis on the start around failing early. If you fail early, you're going to stand up and be better in the future. A bit like footballers when they're young. If you don't encourage them to fail, yeah, they grow up playing with fear. And they will never try and they'll never develop the skills to be truly great. So I think you've got to get some time into fail quite early in projects and invest. And I say this, you've got an early phase R&D in our world because the application into the whatever railway environment it is going to be different, certainly in metros, wherever you go. You might have a client where you can, some parts of the world where you can shut the railway and do what you want and it's plain sailing. If you're coming into a live metro environment, which is traveling, pushing millions of people around the railway every day, you're not going to get that luxury. So you've got to find a way of creating a factory to be successful within that environment. And then once you get good at that, we did it. You know, that one of the first jobs I got was delivering signal sighting on London Underground. Huge challenge. Engaging with the train operators to get their buy-in to the end state design because it's vital that they can obviously see what you're putting up there is safety critical. Trying to install these assets, design and install them within existing railway furniture that's all around and getting the sight lines, phenomenally difficult interface. And kind of when I took over, it was in a little bit of disarray. And again, I built good relationships. And we started going through that factory. Let's get the first one. We had a big challenge with Canada. You know, if we couldn't put the asset where this is the design authority, if we couldn't put the asset where they wanted it, it could take a week to get a response about what tolerances did I have. So it was actually, let's get Canada on a bit of a daily 15-minute, like this is what's come across. Can you give us a rule that works in 80% of the circumstances that I can apply without coming back to you? Actually, that makes sense. And you start building those and finding those quick wins so you can get 80% of the queries out without even having to go back because you've agreed a tolerance rule. We had it with other approvals from the client and I was on the supplier side. If I've got, I'm taking out a gauge structure and I'm going to use that with a competent person if you've been competent, do I have to wait 10 days for you to turn around a clearance form for me? Can you give delegated authority to that person who's competent to take the track gauge to site and allow us to accelerate? And we got that concession signed off because we demonstrated a safe system of work with competent people who could do it. But all these marginal gains were huge for us. And that's my point about the factory. Build it and then optimize it. And by the end of it, you can get really, really good at it. And the best thing for me is when no one talks about your sub project within the bigger program, because I've just said the same thing with signal sighting. Not many people talk about it anymore because it's just become that factory. So it is possible to do, but you have to invest in it.
Yeah, it's. I agree with you. It's a really, really tough message to deliver to say, yeah, we're going to fail a lot in the beginning because we've never done this before. But it's the truth, right? And there's a lot of bureaucracy and politics at play on projects, particularly large projects. And it's a challenge to get around those. And, you know, then we have to go and deliver to, you know, what's been promised. And it's a tough, tough ask. And it creates quite an interesting environment, specifically when commercials come at play. But I don't want to go down the whole route of commercials, etc., because we could probably be here for days talking about that, Joe.
Definitely.
Yeah, but I guess you know, looking back on your illustrious career to date, you know, is there anything sort of, you know, looking back that you change, not necessarily for yourself or your career, but that, you know, those starting off in their careers in projects, delivering projects, that you'd give them advice on to say, hey, look, you know, you're starting out. These are the things you need to look out for. And maybe specifically those looking to get into rail. You know, what are the, you know, you shared a lot about going to site and that, and how to sort of apply what you're doing, gaining experience. But are there any specifics that you think, looking back at your own career, that you'd say, get this done and get this done now. Fail fast now on these particular aspects, because that will be the foundation of what you build your career on.
Yeah, I think and I think it's for the person coming in and the people that are managing that person. So assistant project manager is a great example.
Mm-hmm.
If all you're doing is getting an assistant project manager to do your minutes and your admin, you're doing a huge disservice to yourself and that assistant project manager. And again, I go back to how I was really fortunate. So the minute I landed, I got given scope. It was a tiny bit of scope. It was the SER desk and chairs, the AMP signal and equipment room desks and chairs. And I was kind of dropped in the deep end with a little bit of mentoring to say, go and procure those. Yeah. And I had to develop my schedule, my cost. I had to consider the assurance that went around it. I got real scope very early in my career, which I had to learn fast and I had to make mistakes. I'll never forget it. The first article inspection, I was like, what's that? Well, the client wants to go to the factory and have a look at the desk that you've just spent an obscene amount of money developing from. And I was like, and then it was like, okay, so we booked the first article inspection and then the client was like, I need my travel paid for. I've got a 30-day. I've got to apply for the cost, the travel cost, 20 or 30 days in advance of the travel. And I'm now like a week out. What do I do? Like all of those, that's failing early, right? And understanding all the requirements of all the different people in your mini bit of scope that you need to deliver. So I think it's the sooner you get something tangible to deliver, and experienced the pain of it. I had a young APM who worked for us, and we gave him a small bit of scope, which was emergency stop plungers on the platforms. And yeah, he went from taking minutes to actually now having a real milestone that he needed to deliver that was supporting one of our big commissionings. And there's nothing like when you get something you're accountable that people are relying on you to deliver. That transforms you as a person. And I think that's where you then start to build that career. Now, whether that's in kind of, if I look at the unbelievable work you guys do, right? When you know that first report that's on you that needs to be out for those seniors and the heat is on, right? And you've got late, you've got the functions not giving you the outputs when you need them and you're chasing, you're up till late. Listen, that's, if you don't like that stuff, don't work in projects, right? So you've got to get used to that that environment. But yeah, listen, accountability early. If you're new in the industry, volunteer for everything. Go and learn as much as you can about it and take on responsibility. Because I've got a kind of good saying, it's like, you never lose, you learn. Right?
Yeah.
That's all it is, right? It's all learning. So yeah, put yourself in the firing line early and fail quickly and learn.
If you knew someone who wanted to come into the railway industry, didn't quite know what they wanted to do in life, would you recommend university or would you go straight into an apprenticeship or just go straight into work? Obviously it depends. I know university depends on what you want to do, but if kind of railway, maybe a bit of project management, what they might want to do.
I think there's some phenomenal organizations now that have got great apprenticeship graduate schemes. I know a lot of the top people I've worked with have come through those graduate schemes and apprenticeship schemes. So listen, the cost of, I've got five kids and looking at the cost of university, listen, it's obscene, right?
Shouldn't have got injured, Joe.
Definitely shouldn't have got injured. Yeah. It would have been a lot easier then. But no, look, the cost of it for me now is huge, and you're going to be saddled with debt. And that if you can go in and learn your trade whilst you're getting your qualifications, again, I look at my nephews doing some phenomenal things at Mace. He's a young QS, and he's managed to develop the experience alongside. I think he just got a 2.1 in his degree. So if I compare him to some of his mates who we grew up with, they've just come out of uni and they haven't got the experience. So yeah, I'm massive on learning your trade with an organisation, developing the qualifications alongside that. I think is the best way to do it.
Awesome. Joe, I've got, I guess, one more before we head towards the end of the pod for you. Who's going to win the Women's 2023 World Cup?
Well, I've got to say England, haven't I? Let's hope it's England. It's phenomenal how the women's game's developed, right? And the standard of play now is exceptional. So, yeah, be looking forward to watching that.
Fantastic. Look, before we let you go, we do have a feature, which we haven't done for some time, but we have Machine Gun Martin back on this episode, who's prepared Fiverr. It's a quick fire pop quiz for you. So, Martin, are you ready to take Joe through his paces?
Yeah, let's give it a go. Okay, number one, what's your one piece of advice for people new to the project profession?
Get some scope early and deliver.
Biggest misconception about project management?
Good question. Sorry, say the question again.
What's the biggest misconception about project management?
That the project manager knows everything.
Three. Are good leaders born or made?
Made.
What would be your book recommendation to our listeners?
How to Win Friends and Influence People.
Brilliant. Great. And lastly, if you had your time again, would you go straight into project management, engineering, sports, something else?
Oh. I would do exactly what I've already done. I would start with my passion, which is sport, and this is what life is, right? You've got to see where it takes you. So, as much as it's been some challenges, I wouldn't change a thing.
Fantastic. And I wouldn't change anything for you because we wouldn't have crossed paths, Joe. And it's been an absolute pleasure to kick the tires with you. I feel like there's more we haven't covered yet, but so we'll have to get you back to see what else there is. Maybe perhaps, I don't know, after a major football tournament or something major being delivered, on 4LM or something, and do the comparisons between those. But it's been an absolute pleasure to have you. It's been a long time coming. I know we threatened to have you a little while back, but, clashes didn't allow. But before we let you go, are there any final thoughts you want to leave our listeners with?
Final thoughts. So I would say give freely. No matter what level you're at in an organization, if you give freely, I've never seen anyone lose who gives stuff away for free.
I love that. Absolutely love that. Give freely, folks. And if you like what you've heard, give this episode away freely on your social media as well. Get the word out there. What Joe's discussed with us on this episode is hugely, hugely interesting, important, especially for those aspiring project managers looking to get into not just the rail profession, but project management as a profession. And reach out to Joe. Joe wants to give away freely as well. He doesn't have much time, but I'm sure, Joe, you'll give away some of your time. But it's been a real privilege and pleasure to have you on the podcast. So thank you very much.
Thanks, guys.
So there you have it, folks. That is the end of this episode. But as we said, if you do like what you've heard, please do help us pay it forward by sharing a link to this episode on your favorite social media. Once again, a massive thank you to our guest, Joe Little, and thank you all for listening. Till next time, we say stay safe, be disruptive, and have fun doing it. From me and Martin, it's bye for now.
more information, blogs, or to support our charities, visit projectchatterpodcast.com. And if you would like to sponsor the podcast, get in touch via our website.
You can also leave us a voice message via our anchor page and let us know if there's something or someone specific that you would like on the podcast.
The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this podcast belong solely to the participating individuals and not necessarily to the individual's employer, organization, committee, or other group or individual. Additionally, any views or opinions are not intended to malign any religion, ethnic group, club, organization, company, or individual.